Hi folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world and the changing times and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, May the 15th, 2025, and since it is Thursday, it is time for the Expert Council Show of the Week, and I've got a great lineup of Expert Council new and old for you today. Number one. Government spending needs to be cut, so of course, what are they going to do? Spend more money. That's what we'll hear about from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini. Then how about using permaculture principles to design things other than like gardens and food forests in your landscape, like even companies? Now, I've talked about this before, but I love the approach that Ryan Steva took to it, and he'll be talking about that. And then how about making what's called a sweet and sour salad made completely with foraged herbs? Of course, that must be from Kerry Brown. Nick Ferguson will talk about converting 11 acres of just pine trees into silvo pasture. Good budget guns that don't completely compromise, or that not don't completely, good, but blah, blah. It's been a long week, guys. Good budget guns that don't compromise quality from Mike Melito. Doc Bones will give us then thoughts on body armor. I had actually a surplus of content this week from the Expert Council and just decided that going from good budget guns to body armor made sense, so that's why I picked the final Expert Council member today. And then it brings me to my subject. I said about 2 weeks ago, I think maybe it was this week, I don't know, recently, I said that we really should do a show again on blackout kits. And then I got to thinking about it, and every time I've talked about blackout kits, it's actually been part of a larger show, like on basic preparedness, because it's not that deep of a topic. It's a really simple topic. I can cover it in about 10 minutes, but we haven't talked about it in a long time. And it is one of those core, simple prepper things that gets often overlooked. People that are way over-prepared in some ways often don't have a simple blackout kit. Is the blackout kit like a generator and 60 gallons of gas? No, it's not. It's much more simple than that. So we'll talk about that today and kind of renew that in you if you don't have this done. Or maybe you did it, but you did it so long ago you got some stuff in there with some crusty batteries or something that needs to be checked out because you've been lucky and ain't had a blackout anytime soon. I have no problem keeping my blackout kit up to date because at least twice a year something blows something up somewhere and we end up with no power. So at that point, we always, even if it's the middle of the day and we don't need most of the stuff that's in there, we check for the blackout kit and what's there and is anything need some updates. And we do something else really cool, too, and I'll tell you about that when we get to my segment today. Before we do, I have a few updates for you. Number one, we have a really awesome MSB supporting vendor called NE Seed, which is short for New England Seed. This company's been around forever. They have a tremendous selection of seeds. They're just a fantastic partner and have been. I think we brought them on about 6 years ago. And they're a company that actually cares. So I got a phone call, not an email on this, which is always nice. It turns out the owner is selling the company. What does that mean? She was very honest, lady that called me. They don't know yet. They're not sure what the new owners are going to do, but one thing they do want to do is reduce inventory. What that means is starting the 17th, so not today or tomorrow, but starting Saturday and running for about a week, they're doing a sale that's 25% off everything on the site. Now, here's a couple things about it. One, there's still a ton of time to plan a lot of things, so it might be a good time to pick up some product from them during this sale, and you won't need any code. They're just putting everything on a 25% off to cut inventory. But two, they do a 20% off discount for MSB. Don't get too excited. This is the but, right? So, but they're going to turn our code off during the sale because that would be, when you stack the two together, it's actually more than 45%. It's about 50%. And they would be bleeding money at that rate. And that's not what they're trying to do. They're just trying to do inventory reduction sale. So our code will not work during the time, but you'll get 5% more off. And then if you don't pick stuff up and need something after it, our code will continue to work. Now, by fall garden season, will any seeds still be doing business? I don't know. It sounds like they will, but I also detected some uncertainty. They didn't say who's the buyer, and I would imagine if the man's retiring, he's probably selling his business. But if the buyer could simply fold them into another, you just don't know yet. I would also say this, like, this is not a small company here, so I'm not talking about something you do with a credit card. But if you, you know, the kind of person that buys businesses, it probably wouldn't hurt for you to reach out to me and me to connect you with them. Maybe they would be interesting in selling to somebody in the community that wants to keep the company on track. Instead of being merged into some giant conglomerate like Burpee or something like that. Not that I hate Burpee, they're not the same. You know what I mean? They're not a Victory Seeds. They're not an NE Seed, you know. They're not a Terroir Seeds. They are, you know, a giant corporate thing. And so maybe there's an opportunity there. I don't really know, but I did want you to know about that. The next is, again, I just want to thank all of you for feedback on Laws of Life so far being just great. We're still hitting bestseller lists on Amazon, even after the big surge. We're not number one, number two in the top categories for books, but we are like number one, number two, number three in Kindle categories, and we're still like top 10 in most of the other categories. And that's a pretty big deal to be a brand new author. And again, competing against some really big authors and some really large publishing houses to be self-published. So thank you for that. I want to say this. If you've picked the book up, and I've specifically said, you know, kind of read it before you do a review. So there's not any real reviews there yet. But, you know, some of you have gotten your book a couple days ago. You're halfway through it. When you feel comfortable, please leave me a review. Even if you're like, I thought Jack was good and this sucks, go ahead. I don't care. Being honest with your review, but I need reviews to keep the momentum going here. I'll also tell you, like, somebody reached out to me today, and I think we're going to come to an agreement to do retypesetting of the book, and then I can update that. And I don't think it'll be any problem. We're going to figure out how to get it done. I read his response to me, and it was all positive. And I already saw, like, a sample of the work that he does, and it's very good. There are some typesetting issues with it. And it's primarily because when you do KDP, which is the self-publishing platform with Amazon, they give you a template to work with that's an MS Word template. And I do all my writing on a Mac and then convert. And I think that was a mistake. So there's some things that can be fixed there, and he's going to do that. And so there might be a second edition very soon. The upside of that, the ones with, you know, some typesetting issues and all might be, you know, kind of rare in the future if we can sell, you know, tens of thousands of copies instead of 1,000 copies, you know, and you'd have those first, 1,000 books that got out there with, you know, some line setting issues and stuff like that. Man, maybe it would have some, I don't know. I ain't promising nothing, but just know that's the case, and I do need reviews. The AI course, I have people asking me a question about it that I want to be very clear about, because I don't want anybody taking it and not getting what they expect. They want to know, if I don't have a business and I don't want a business, is this course for me? And the honest answer is probably no. Because this is all about taking an idea or an existing business and developing all sorts of things specifically for business. It was designed that way from the get-go, out of the gate. Things like lead magnets, follow-up email systems, and stuff like that. So if you're looking to figure out like a home maintenance schedule, this is not for you. Now, that said, I like doing these courses. They're pretty quick to do. This one was long, but it's not that long compared to something like a biochar course or a bioreactor course. There's a tremendous amount of interest. It seems way more than even the permaculture stuff as far as the general interest level. So is there something that you would like a course developed for ChatGPT? You know, here's some thoughts I had. I had, like, what about a course that taught you how to develop your own emergency management program for your home? I could do that. That probably doesn't even need, like, the instructor-led. That's probably, like, you get it as a downloadable kit for, like, $25. Or is there other things, like how to develop a badass self-development educational program with it or something? If there's something that you specifically would want to do with it better and want guidance and structure to develop it for yourself, I'm not saying we'll do them all, but I'm saying we can look at it. And the same way as anything, TSPC in the subject line, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. We'll take a look at it. So there's a longer intro than usual for a Thursday show, but those are three important things I wanted to let you know about. Any seed, sale coming, discount code won't work during the sale. You know, I know I'm still going to get like 25 emails to say, it doesn't work. The price is better with the sale. Use the sale. You know, the book, need reviews, and of course, AI course is really this one coming out soon, for solopreneurs. All right, with that, let's go ahead and dive on into it with Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini. The government says they want to cut money, so cut spending, has promised to cut spending, found tons of waste, and so what are they going to do? Increase spending.
I'm trying to figure out who's the best manager of our money. Is it the president or is it the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board? And I've come up to a conclusion that I'm sure you'll be able to address it and explain that to me. Maybe neither one is able to be considered a good manager of the money. I would say they're arguing over, you know, who's the most guilty in messing things up.
Right, Dr. Paul. We are in a big mess. There's a new face in the White House. It's a familiar face because he was there before, but the mess is still the same and getting bigger. And it's because it's very easy to understand the government is not shrinking. The problem in America is the size and scope of our government. It was supposed to shrink. People voted for it very enthusiastically. I remember all the speeches, Ramaswamy, Elon Musk. It was countless speeches of all the things that were going to happen to get government off our backs, and it's not happening at all. And unfortunately, the most exciting, especially from my perspective, aspect of the second Trump administration was DOGE, and that is fading into obscurity. It's because the politicians were never, you know, they liked the pictures with Elon Musk that they took, and they liked tweeting how great DOGE is. But when it comes to actual, we're going to cut the government, not going to happen. And Thomas Massey was right once again, because he knew it was not going to happen, and he was lambasted on X by the influencers, you know, who are really no different than the people on TV. They're just on X. Who said, get on board with the Trump agenda. Anyone who goes against the Trump agenda is going to get steamrolled and primaried. Primary Thomas Massey. The cuts, the rescissions will come later. You'll see. He was right. They are not coming. Government spending and debt are going to skyrocket even more. So this is the issue that we're in. It's like we were taken once again. Because government is not shrinking, the troops aren't coming home, the wars aren't ending, and the government is still on our backs. And that's the problem that we face.
I want to read the note that Trump sent out his posting regarding this issue. It was probably yesterday. He says, too late. He's referring to Jerome Powell. Jerome Powell is a fool who doesn't have a clue. That's pretty harsh. Other than that, I like him very much. Oil and energy way down. Grocery prices, eggs are down. Virtually no inflation. tariff money pouring into the U.S. Wow. Boy, we live in great times. But
yes, that Trump calls Powell a fool. And what Powell does is foolish. It's a fool's errand. He doesn't know what interest rates should be. None of them do. It's arbitrary. They set it based on the goals that they want to achieve, and they hope that they'll achieve the goals by fixing prices. So it's foolish, but at the same time, Trump is being foolish. He's with setting the tariffs. He doesn't know what the tariffs should be. This morning I wrote Trump, 80% tariffs on China seems right. Well, why not 76%? Why not 83.2%? It's arbitrary. He doesn't know what tariff rates should be. So this is more central planning. You have one guy fixing interest rates, another guy fixing tariff rates, and neither of them know what either of them should be. So this is more central planning nonsense in our lives that we can do without both of them. And it's a shame because they're both being foolish.
This is one of those, I agree, but, and here's the but, I think that many in the libertarian world, judging this exclusively through the libertarian lens, which is useful but limited. And it's limited because the world does not operate in any way through a libertarian lens. You can say what we should do. We can make moral approximations here, and in our own lives we can make decisions based on our moral ideology. But when we're judging the actions of a country, because it's not the actions of Donald Trump, It's the actions of the United States of America. He just happens to be president at the moment, and some of the things are things he's doing because he wants to. Some are things he's doing because of things he wants to get done, and he has to. Some of the things are being done by people in his cabinet that have authority and autonomy beyond things he can actually rein in. Once you appoint certain people, they can do some things. They don't need your approval, and you can get rid of them, but then you have to replace them. So if you just disagree with like one or two things they're doing, but it's kind of like still getting your agenda done, and they're solid on everything else, and you don't have to go back through the fucking Senate for a hearing, you might leave them in place. And some of the things that are being done beyond what the president can even choose. So this is the action of a country, okay? Now, he is leading it, and some of the things are 100% him. And some of the things are partially him, and some of the things are just more bureaucracy in the government itself. And it's also, those are interactions with the actions of other nations. And when I look at what's happening right now, our economy is very likely, over the next 4 years, to explode in a boom that you can't even imagine yet. I mean, like, I know he says it all the time, and everything is like everybody's saying, nothing they ever saw before. And he's usually over the top bullshitting with it. No, I think that's what you're about to get. Now, could it crash and burn? Could I be wrong? Yeah, but I don't think so. When I look at the way all the pieces are coming together, and the sheer volume of investment that is being brought into the United States... We're measuring multiple trillions of dollars in the first quarter of a year. Are you kidding me? Right? And the Democrats are busy worried about the fact that the Qataris are giving us a 747 for free because they're giving it to Donald Trump. They're not giving it to Donald Trump. It's not Donald Trump's plane. It's a plane that will be flown as Air Force One. Yes, but it belongs to the United States of fucking America. So I think there's a little too much pessimism from libertarians on this. And I think it's because they all in, even the ones that supported Trump because they knew he was better than Cackles, they really didn't want him to be what they wanted. So even where he's close, they're unhappy. And I think that's happening a lot. And I think this is a point in time with the election's over. Things are what they are. Instead of worrying about what people are doing and what they should be doing and what they're not doing, etc. Like, there's so much I can bitch about. How about Pam Bondi and Cash Patel? Where's the Epstein files? But you know what that will do for me? Raise my blood pressure. It won't make me more money. It won't make me a better grandfather. It won't make me a better father. It won't make me a better husband. Right? It won't make me a better podcaster. Maybe I'll get more people to look at me. But I won't get more people looking at me that actually do shit, which is what I actually want in my community. People that go out and build families, that build homesteads, that build businesses, that build and design their lives. So I'm willing to say, hey, the good of this is there's going to be a lot of opportunity out of it. A tremendous amount of opportunity on it. Let's figure out how we can capitalize on it. And I'd be saying that if freaking Cackles was president, except it wouldn't be as optimistic, I promise you that. And not because I don't like Cackles, because she wouldn't be doing any of the things that are actually going to be beneficial to this country. Huge amounts of money are coming into this country already, and more is going to come. And it's not inflation, because it's not money that's being printed. It's money that's being repatriated. It's U.S. dollars that went abroad coming back to invest in America. That's a good thing. Does that mean I'm okay with what's going on in Gaza? No. But I'm not the Ben and Jerry's guy screaming in a hearing with RFK Jr. talking about HHS services, about it being something about cutting Medicaid to blow up Gaza, because it's completely delusional and disconnected. We in the libertarian world need to not emulate the left. We need to not emulate the left. You know the old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend? It ain't true in politics, folks. Let's move on and talk about permaculture design outside of what we think of as permaculture things with Ryan Steva.
Hey, TSB community, this is Ryan Steva. Today I want to talk about permaculture principles and using those design principles in other areas of your life other than just food, homestead, design systems. So, for example, this could be parenting. You could use the principles in investing. You can use the principles in business development and growth. So there are a myriad of ways you can use these principles of permaculture to design your entire life. I want to mention that David Holmgren has a free pamphlet that has his 12 principles of permaculture in it, as well as the ethics, prime directive, and some descriptions. So I would encourage you all to download that and to actually read it maybe once a week for the next couple of months with some of the things I'm talking about today in mind as you read it. As you read it, think about how you can apply the principles to different aspects of your life. To drive home the idea of how powerful these design principles are, let me give you an example of how they could be used or how they have been used in the past, divorced from ethics. Because if you just remove the ethics, I literally think you could take over the world with these design principles. They're literally that powerful. So let's do a little thought experiment. Imagine you're an oil tycoon and you've already cornered the oil market. But you want to do more than corner the oil market. You want something else. Well, there's a few design principles that might actually help you in that. One is produce no waste. That's principle number 6 of David Holmgren. Principle number 8 is to integrate rather than segregate. And in the permaculture community, that's often stated as function stacking or stacking functions. Another common principle that people use but is not one of David Holmgren's is the concept of the problem is the solution. So let's put those three principles together and think about what an oil tycoon might do with the byproduct or waste product that he already has. If you remove the ethics, those byproducts or waste products can be turned into another product, which with principle number 2, catch and store energy. And money is essentially a store of energy. We could repackage those waste products into something called pharmaceuticals because we've realized that the waste products actually have a tremendous impact on the physiological function of the human body. But let's say we didn't get a lot of traction initially in selling those waste products. We might do something like create a nonprofit to funnel some of the money that we have made in the oil industry into promoting our products, but we do it in such a way that we can actually reduce our tax liability while promoting our next product. That nonprofit could then also fund medical schools and medical research that drove conclusions towards our product. Then if we're function stacking, we could also create petrochemicals that could be used on farmland that would require ongoing and increased amounts of petrochemicals to keep that system operational, while at the same time making people sicker and needing more of our pharmaceuticals. I think that we could all talk for hours on how all these functions stack together and all the different ways that we're actually using the various permaculture principles that I've already mentioned as well as others to make a business that encompasses the health of the entire world, the function of all agriculture. But I hope it gives you a little bit of an idea of how these principles can be used, stacked together, and made into something that is extremely powerful, but it's not okay to divorce the ethics. While I'm at it, let me give one more analogy. Let's think of children if we could analogize them as a piece of property. Now that might sound harsh or weird to you, but hear me out. A piece of property, you really don't own it. It will be there long after you're gone, and ideally, you're going to be working towards making that piece of property able to function on its own. So let's say you have really nice flat land with great soil. That's maybe analogous to a child who's easygoing, wants to listen to instructions. Well, if you take that property or that field and you just till it and plant corn, use agrochemicals, after 20 years of doing that, that field is worse off instead of better off. It looked really good because it was highly productive, but the second you step away from it, it'll fall apart. But what if instead, during that 20 years, you were planting trees, making silvopasture, setting it up so that when you walked away, the system would continue to not only do well, but get better and better over time? You can keep building on this analogy with children in that, let's say you have a child who's really difficult to work with. That's kind of like a piece of land that is hilly, rocky, has weeds, things like that, where if you manage it properly, it will become an ecosystem that can build on itself as opposed to something that will just crash and burn the second you walk away. Let's throw another few analogies on top. Maybe for the original analogy of a flat, highly productive field, we think of tilling kind of like yelling, and maybe agrochemicals like spanking. Every time you till or yell at your child, it's going to do damage and it's not going to be beneficial. It's actually going to be degradative. However, there might be times when yelling would be appropriate or where tilling would be appropriate. Let's say you're trying to make a footpath on contour, or you've got soil that is so hard that it can't absorb water at all. An initial small amount of tilling could actually repair that or create a nice on-contour path that becomes beneficial for getting things in and out or getting access to the property. If your child is getting too close to a cliff face or about to do something that's going to kill them, yelling is probably an appropriate way to get their attention if done properly. Or also, if you think about it, a two-year-old who thinks it's very funny to run out in front of traffic because it freaks you out, a spanking might be a way to give them a physical consequence that doesn't kill them, like a car running them over, so they get the idea that that is a bad idea. But it's not something that you want to do to correct every problem. That would be destructive towards that child. Or maybe think of a word as a seed. Every word that you speak to your child could be a seed. It could be a seed that causes problems, or it could be a seed that grows an incredible tree that produces for years and years to come. Well, that's it for me. You can find all my information at thehomesteadconsultant.com. Thanks, everyone.
That's a great way to look at it, to like go to just extremes in some ways with it. And then that lets you pare it down to things like, how can I put this into my small business and not get rid of the ethics? That's why I said I really liked the way that he came at this from an angle of, like, what if they're like a giant Dr. Evil, $1 gazillion, $1 billion grabbed onto those principles and jettisoned the ethics? But I'll put it a different way. What if those giant corporations grabbed onto them and incorporated the ethics? They are not going to anytime soon. One or two of them might at some point. It's not like you can't win and be ethical. And it's certainly not the case that you can't win and be ethical. Like, you can do that with your own business or your own life or whatever it is you're designing. And so I have a link to the PDF that he mentioned in the show notes today, right under his bullet point. And just under that bullet point, you'll see a bullet point that says, my free principle-based design course. That's for me. At Home Food Systems, we have a principle-based design course based on those very principles. That is absolutely free. It's like a 4-hour course with a certification test, everything. It's completely free, so you can see how things work at Home Food Systems. And there's a link there, or you just go to homefoodsystems.com and click on the link for courses there, and you can sign up for it. And of course, there are other paid courses there as well. Now let's hear about making a sweet and sour salad. It has nothing to do with citrus or Chinese stuff. It's all from foraging from Kerry Brown.
Hey, TSP community, Kerry here from Strong Roots Resources. Just a little while ago, I've wrapped up taking a little pasture walk, setting up some fence for the sheep, and I just couldn't help but notice how much has come available this time of year. Now, we've had a lot of rain, a little more rain than usual for us here in East Tennessee. Some things are out a little early, and actually quite a few things, because we've stayed cool, have been sort of slow to go to seed. So I kind of feel like we're at a nice opportunity, especially in this region and hopefully in your area too, to gather all sorts of things to call or to make what I call my sweet and sour salad. So I'll run through this list here in a minute. We're going to go for things that have kind of some sour flavor. It's going to be a little higher in oxalates. So if you are sensitive to that sort of thing, too much food that contains oxalates can cause some kidney issues. So, you know, if you're not sure, just kind of run this stuff through a good foraging book like Samuel Thayer's Field Guide or something similar. Just double check, because some of this stuff, of course, is, while it is food, it can also be medicine and can even interact with certain medications, especially things like Coumadin, other blood thinners. So all that to say, there is a lot available right now. I'm going to run through this list, and then I'll kind of tell you how I would put it together. So right now, there is red and white clover, and in this case, I'm talking about using the flowers. There is sheep sorrel. Try to find it where it hasn't already gone to seed. Wild violet, and in this case, we'll want to use the leaves. So younger, tender leaves are better. When they start to get real bushy, they tend to get kind of fibrous. So the young leaves, and if you have flowers, we'll use those as well. Lamb's quarters, these should still be pretty young. And if you are colder than East Tennessee, they might not be up yet. Passion flower, we'll be looking at the leaves in this case. Dandelion flower and leaves. Wood sorrel leaves. Honeysuckle flowers and thistle. And for the thistle, we'll be working with either the mid ribs of the biggest leaves or the stalk. And in that case, be prepared to have gloves and something to peel them with. So, like I said, we've got kind of the ideal weather, ideal growing season right now to enjoy really fresh salad. And while I grow plenty of mixed greens and kales and all that kind of stuff, there's just something that just can't be beat with going out and fetching this stuff out of your pastures, out of, you know, areas in your yard that hopefully don't get sprayed or mowed or otherwise overly managed. And I would take, of all of everything I've listed here, I would probably take, you know, maybe a couple of small handfuls of each, and this would probably generate enough to at least split between a couple of people, which is what I'm accustomed to doing here. So a couple of handfuls of each of the species that I ran through is going to give you a pretty nice balance of, like I said, sweet and sour. So your flowers are going to kind of cover that sweet side. The sheep sorrel and the wood sorrel will kind of be the ones that have the strongest tanginess. So if you're not as big a fan of that, go light or just leave those out. And when I blend this all together, I just kind of toss it in a big mixing bowl, just kind of blend everything together real nice. And I usually hit it with some kind of balsamic vinegar type dressing. But really, whatever floats your boat will be great. And, you know, one of the things about foraging is, you know, these plants are operating in such a way that they are generally able to contain considerable nutrient density. And not so long ago at the Living Free in Tennessee Spring Workshop, I attended one of the classes by Ellen Booker where he actually got into using a refractometer to measure bricks, to measure actual nutrient density off of a plant. And turns out I'll be doing more of that here on the farm, because now I'm curious. Now I really want to know. Like, I always have an idea and I always have a sense of that, but I'd like to kind of see some data and read that. So that's another rabbit hole altogether. I might get into that at some point. So just take all those things, blend them up, throw some dressing on it. I looked around for something kind of like crunchy to be foraged. And if you have, you know, like last year's nut harvest, that would kind of be what I would go to. I couldn't really find anything today that would fit the bill to kind of give you that crunchy texture. But, in other words, you guys just kind of heard what I'll be pulling together to go with our dinner later on tonight. One other quick detail, I almost forgot about the thistle. Your thistle could be, depending on what stage it's in, it could just still be hanging out as a rosette just on the ground. I wouldn't really bother with it at that stage. If yours is starting to put a stalk and is starting to put off those side shoots and everything, then you can you know, put on some gloves, harvest it. I usually use either just a decent paring knife or even a potato peeler and take off the spines. And that can... generally, I have found that not a spicker, I guess, but thistle, when harvested this time of year, has a flavor like actual celery, not the stuff from the grocery store that just tastes like crunchy water, but a nice kind of celery is the closest I got, guys. And when you're making your dressing, if you have a little bit of celery salt or celery seed to throw in with that dressing, that works really well too. So get out there and make yourself some kind of sweet and sour or wild salad. Also wanted to let you guys know that I've got a foraging class here on the farm, May 10th. That's this coming Saturday. We're in West Knox County in Tennessee. So if you're in the area and you hear this and you would like to come out to one of our foraging classes or any of the other classes that I teach here, just give me a holler at strongrootsresources@gmail.com. I'll send you the address and directions. It's $20 a person. The little ones are welcome as long as you can keep a good eye on them and keep them safe. So bring your children, bring your friends, bring your family members, and we'll have a great time out here. So thank you so much. We will talk to you next time.
So Kerry also mentioned a link. I do have a link in the show notes right under his bullet point for today. I will say just one thing on this. When you look at any kind of a green salad, whether it is something like a completely foraged salad or if it involves like all greens you grew or if it's a mix of both, the approach of using a lot of different greens and putting them together is a really great way to go. Let me explain with that. Like, I actually like a salad of just arugula, but if it's really good, sharp arugula, but that sharpness is a bit much for some people. I grow a green called New Zealand spinach, which is not related to spinach at all. It's actually a perennial in my climate. It's fantastic if it's mixed in with other greens. And I also grow a green that has a little bit of a mucilage type thing going on, kind of like okra does, but it's not as much, called Malabar spinach, which is also not related to spinach, and it's a perennial but not in my climate. And I grow a lot of lamb's quarters, and I do harvest dandelion greens. Except for the arugula, there isn't a thing I just said that would actually taste really great as a standalone salad green by itself, in my opinion. When they're mixed together, something happens. There's like an enhancement and canceling of certain taste characteristics that balances out. So I would just say that that's, you know, something to consider. The other thing is, one of the reasons you might want to do this is nutrient density. A lot of gardeners that even have pretty good results have fairly low nutrient density food, especially early on before they fully develop their soil profile. When you forage wild edibles, even on your own property, even growing right next to your garden, etc., you often end up with very highly nutrient dense food. And the reason is simple: you didn't plant it. And the reason nature is beautiful is because things that are not super strong and capable of standing up for themselves die. That's why nature is so beautiful, because anything that's weak dies. And so when you forage wild foraging, you're always going to end up with the strongest of the survivors, the ones that can make the most out of what's available. And they're always growing in the spot that's best for them. We put, you know, a plant like a tomato, and we stick it in this spot in our garden because the solar aspect's right, and we have a support for it back there, and that we can attach it to the support, and that's just where we want our tomato. A wild plant grows wherever it wants to, because the spot is best for that plant to grow. Just a little add-on there. Next, let's hear about Nick and converting pine trees into silvopasture.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with an expert counsel answer for Daniel on converting wooded pine trees to silvopasture. Hey, Jack and Nick, what is the best way to convert 11 acres of wooded pine trees to silvopasture? Details: we have 30 acres that are currently wooded except a 1.5-acre build site. 11 acres... are exclusively pines, and the remainder is a mix of trees. We want to convert the 11 acres of pines to silvopasture with fodder trees for livestock. We will likely start off with sheep, as we have never raised ruminants, but long term we would like to have cattle. If the land supports it, we would rotationally graze, and we'll have chickens and pigs as well. We aren't looking to start a commercial enterprise, just enough to feed our almost exclusively carnivorous family that goes through a lot of meat in a year. Thanks, Daniel. All right. Daniel, that is a huge question, and to be completely honest, it's one that really deserves an on-site consult. I hate to say that. There is just so freaking much at play that this is the textbook definition of one of those questions that Jack and I jokingly refer to as an "it depends" situation. I'm going to try and answer in the most generic way possible. I know I'm going to rabbit trail. I hope you don't just follow this answer, because I have no idea if this is actually going to be a good solution. It's just off the top of my head, this is kind of what it makes me think about. All right, so here goes. I hope this turns out all right. 11 acres of pine. I have no idea if it's usable timber or not. Depending on your timeline, how much pressure you feel to get this ball rolling, and how quickly you want to convert the property to production, how much money you're going to throw at it, lots of different factors here. But pines to good pasture is probably going to take about 5 years plus, unless you dump a lot of money into it. So, first off, I'd start by harvesting whatever you can and converting that into money. If it's usable timber, then sell it. Get it clear cut. If it's pulpwood, same thing. Sell it. Burn all the slash. We are talking about clear cutting. Don't even worry about trying to make it into biochar or hugel mounds. You've got 11 acres. It's going to be a lot of work. Just pile it up. Burn it to ash. Spread the ash out if you can. If it's in the budget, I'd have lime spread on the entire 11 acres if it's at all accessible and possible. And then, again, if it's in the budget, you can broadcast a pasture mix in the springtime so it can hopefully get established with spring rains. If you can afford to fertilize it also, then absolutely do that. What's going to happen is when you take out that overstory, a whole bunch of weedy pioneer species are going to pop up, and the sheep will love to eat them. So you're going to have edible stuff the first year that you harvest it. It's just not going to be good grass and forbs. It's going to be a lot of brush, which honestly, goats will do better on that than sheep. Sheep will do okay, but goats will do the best on that kind of a situation. And pigs will actually do pretty well on that. That is the fastest affordable option. You don't want silvopasture with sheep when we're talking about like fodder trees that you're going to be cutting to feed the sheep. I can almost guarantee you. You might, but it's going to require a little bit more actual expertise to do it right, setting it up and knowing what you're doing. It's more complicated. It can be more productive, but it's going to be a lot more work. I actually plan on teaching a class on this, if all goes well, early next year. So actually, if you sign up for a consult this year, you're going to get a free ticket to attend that class, whether it's next year or the following year. I don't want to say too much about what's going on because the ink isn't dry just yet. I kind of hinted at this at some previous responses and at Jack's workshop. But if things go to plan this year, you should be seeing a class on that exact topic coming out. If you're going to be doing primarily sheep and you're wanting to bring in fodder trees and you're going to do this smart, you're actually going to allocate an acre or two closer to the house site for fodder in a coppice lot with enough lane space to tractor birds and rabbits between the rows of fodder trees. I guarantee you'll be able to hold more sheep on your land if you allocate an acre of fodder to every 10 acres of pasture. The extra acre of pasture will not be worth nearly as much in production as an acre of mulberry. You can do pollarded trees as silvopasture, but it's way more work than an acre of coppice trees. I can guarantee you that as well. Lots of reasons to coppice over pollarding. I'd use overstory calorie crop trees like persimmon, chestnut, and white oak for your silvopasture. Those trees get protected while you're converting the regrowth weedy pioneer species that are going to pop up after the pine harvest. You can probably even just select a bunch of those clumps of trees for saving as silvopasture clumps, because they're direct, wild-sown, and grown, which is ideal. But really, man, I can 100% guarantee if you had me out to do a consult, I will save you thousands in mistakes. If you have me out to do a consult before you get started, that is. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times, literally hundreds of times, if not into the thousands of times, I've stepped foot on someone's land and immediately seen like at least $10,000 in mistakes I could have saved the person with 10 minutes. Sometimes it's six figures of savings. I prevented a person from building in a major flood risk location on more than one occasion. So, like, it can be kind of a big deal if you don't know what you're looking at. And you're going to be doing infrastructure type stuff. Fencing, barns, roads. Oh my gosh, roads. I can't tell you how much money you save if you know where to put a road and you can put it there smart. So even if you don't hire me, get someone competent to help you figure things out. Honestly, I bet my fencing solutions alone would save you four times what the consult would cost right off the bat. I wish I could convey it all in one of these segments, but I just have a couple minutes. There's just no way to get as in-depth as we'd need to be, and I just don't have the information in front of me. I really need to see your property. So, short recap, clear cut. Select for saving the natural overstory species for silvopasture. Use sheep and seeding to establish that pasture. It's going to take a couple years to convert that regrowth into actual good grass and forbs. And then I would plant a protected coppice lot of fodder trees for cut and carry. Stay tuned for more news and to get on the Great American Consulting Tour this summer. Shoot me an email with consulting in the subject line to nick@homegrownliberty.com. Do good things.
Next up, let's hear from Mike Melito from Good Shepherd Trading on some really great budget guns that don't compromise on quality.
Hey there, TSP. Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast. Doing a segment for you here on a good budget gun in a couple of different categories. Obviously, these aren't going to be the best in every category. And they may not be the cheapest in every category either. But good, functional, for their intended purpose, and made in America. Not some cheap Turkish clone or Chinese A70 wannabe or something. Good, made in America firearms that are affordable relative to a lot of other things in their category, and that work. The first one, let's go with a handgun. Smith & Wesson SD9VE. Not a very catchy name, but a very good price on a very good practical defensive handgun. They're a polymer striker-fired handgun made in America by Smith & Wesson. They even have decent ergonomics. They have a stainless steel slide. 16 round capacity, 22.7 ounces. It's got good specs, and I've used these. I'm not about to make one my duty gun. I work as a private security contractor. If you said that I had to use it, I'd be like, fine, okay. And saw some on their website, listed on Smith & Wesson website for under $400 at the time of this recording. That's a really good value. They make them in 9 and 40, get it in 9, even make some compliant ones if you live in a restrictive state. It's a good gun. Are there cheaper guns? Yeah, made in Turkey, made in China. High points are good guns. They're cheaper. They're big and bulky. This looks and carries and feels and shoots like a gun that should cost a lot more money. The Smith & Wesson SD9VE. Next, let's go with a shotgun. The Maverick 88. It is a cheaper version of the Mossberg 500, but it's still made in America. It's not made in Turkey. It's not made in China. It is made in America. Somewhere in Texas, if memory serves correct, one of the Texas, Arizona, somewhere down there, it's made. They come in a bunch of different configurations. They're all good. I want to say you can still maybe find them for under $200, certainly under $300. The amount of flexibility you get with a good pump shotgun. They make them in 20 and 12. Just the amount of utility you get with a good pump shotgun in 20 gauge or 12 gauge, buckshot, slugs, hunt anything from mourning doves to deer. I took my elk this year not with a Maverick 88, but with a 12 gauge slug. The shotgun can't be beat for pure versatility. And the fact that you can get a good Maverick 88 that works, that's rugged, reliable. Maybe it doesn't have the bells and whistles and the fit and finish of some higher-end guns, but it'll work. They're a workhorse. And they're a crazy good value. It's the amount of stuff you can do with that shotgun for the price. It's kind of mind-blowing to me. Yeah, a Maverick 88 is a good, fine, budget shotgun. Next, let's go with a rifle. I'm talking like a bolt-action hunting rifle. The Savage Axis. These are crazy affordable. I see them in the $400-and-some range. You can get them mounted. You can get them with an optic. Usually it's a 3-9. They come in all kinds of calibers, from 223 to 308, 30-06. Most of the popular calibers the Savage Axis can be had in. Every one that I've ever owned has been crazy accurate, to the point where if it had cost three times as much money, I would have been like, yeah, that's plenty accurate for the money. Savage, in general, their rifles are very accurate. I'll be honest, I think most Savage bolt-action rifles are pretty ugly. They just are, right? To me. You might think they look great. But it's an affordable rifle that shoots really good. They're also available in stainless steel. My opinion is if you can go stainless, almost always go stainless. That's just me. But they got them in stainless. They got them with camo stocks. They have them with the AccuTrigger. They got them in all kinds of popular calibers. They're a good American-made bolt-action rifle. And, again, everyone that I've ever had has been very, very accurate. The next one's kind of hard because there's three really good contenders that are kind of neck and neck. The Ruger makes a really good base model AR-15. Smith & Wesson makes their sport model, which is a very good, affordable AR-15. Either one of those would be good. I'm going to recommend Palmetto State Armory. Now, I do believe these are made in America. I could be wrong. Maybe not every part's made in America, but Palmetto State Armory, it's kind of mind-blowing the quality you get. And I've got some experience with PSA ARs. The first one I ever got, I was doing a lot of AR stuff and training, and I thought instead of putting a ton of rounds through my really, really good high-end AR, I'm just going to get a cheap PSA. I'm going to run it hot and dirty, put it away wet. If it breaks, it breaks. If it malfunctions, that's just better training. Like, I wasn't expecting a whole lot out of it. And I was blown away by how good it was. So it became one of my kind of go-to ARs because I ran it hard and it worked. It just worked. It was a good AR, not just for the money. It was a good AR, period. And I have another one, and it's also a very good AR. What makes them go jockeying into the first slot here is they do a thing called daily deals on their website, and I'm not sponsored by any of these guys, none of these gun companies. I refuse sponsors on my show. But they do a thing called daily deals on there. If you're just patient, unless you want one like right now, they kind of cycle through models that they have over stock, or maybe they're just trying to get you on the website. They do a thing called daily deals, and they'll have crazy good deals on there. The fact that you can get a really good fighting carbine in the year of our Lord 2025 with inflation and everything for $400-and-something, it's kind of mind-blowing. So keep an eye out on their daily deals if you're interested in one. If you're wanting a certain model, just wait till it goes on the daily deals or one that's similar. If you just want a kind of plain, you know, 16-inch carbine, there's probably one on there almost every day on their daily deals. And if it's not, the regular prices aren't bad either. But, again, I've kind of been blown away by the quality that you get for the money with the Palmetto State Armory ARs. I think a lot of us look back with nostalgia on, you know, the end of the Cold War and those days, and you could get a Mosin for under $100 and an SKS for, you know, $100-and-some. Yeah, those days are gone. But we are kind of in the good old days of affordable ARs and some really good effective handguns, and the amount of variety now just is kind of mind-blowing. And for every one of these I mentioned, there's probably several more that I didn't mention. This wasn't an exhaustive list. This is a brief segment for the TSP community. There's a lot of really good stuff out there. So if it's a good value, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Thanks, Jack, for having me on. Thanks, TSP. Have a blessed day.
So I'm sitting there listening to that with you guys. I didn't actually get a chance to listen to his segment until I was putting the show together today, which with him, I don't even worry about it. I know it's going to be good. I don't have to screen it at all. I have to say that's true about most of my experts, but with Mike, definitely. And I'm just going, you have to say Palmetto State Armory somewhere in this. Like, there's just too much stuff that Palmetto State Armory has that's amazing and inexpensive. You cannot leave them off. So I'm glad he got there. I want to throw out there is, like, for instance, I pulled up their website today, and they have a deal, a bundle right now. It is an AR-15. Both of these are 5.56. It's a bundle. It's one lower that comes with a standard upper and has a second upper with it for $699.98. Let me say it again. It's an AR lower with two great uppers that have different kind of functional reasons you'd want them. I'll leave it at that. One is way better for putting optics on than the other. So you could buy one AR and be running irons and optics at the same time for $700. And if you look at everything he put together, you could buy everything he put together, especially if you don't go to my bundle, for about $1,600 and have a four-gun arsenal. Are you kidding me? Yeah, the days of buying not just cheap Mosins, but like three Yugo SKSs for $189 as a bundle, like that's gone. But there's some really great stuff out there. Let me say a little bit about Palmetto State Armory before we move on to Dr. Bones on body armor. Palmetto State Armory is everything I want Kel-Tec to be, and they're not. And that they come up with some really innovative shit. Like, some of the stuff, like I sent it a text message to J.R. Haley, who many of you guys know, and my buddy David. The three of us have like a group text that just goes on and on and on forever. And yesterday I saw that PSA, Palmetto State Armory, is releasing some stuff in 338 ARC, 338 ARC. It's basically the 33 caliber version of the 300 Blackout. And I'm reading right here, right now, exactly what I sent JR and David when I saw this. Why won't they leave me and my money alone? Right? Like, the cost effectiveness is almost dangerous to a gun collector with what PSA does. And I do love what they do, and they make very high quality. Are they as innovative as Kel-Tec? Not quite. I would give the innovation edge to Kel-Tec. This is the difference. When PSA says, we have this gun, I can freaking buy it. I don't have to wait 3.5 years to actually be able to get my hands on one if I'm lucky. Like, Kel-Tec's like, we're a machine shop, and we make all these cool guns, and when we have extra time, we'll make more of the guns. PSA's like, we make guns. And if we say we make a gun and you want to buy the gun, guess what? You can. And that's what I really love about them. I don't know, maybe some kind of little rivalry from Kel-Tec and PSA will spin up, and maybe it'll make Kel-Tec better. Who knows? Because competition is good for business. Anyway, let's hear from Dog Bones on body armor now.
Hi, Joe Walton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Last time, I talked about ballistic trauma because armed conflict between two survival groups, that's a real possibility in long-term survival settings. Since that's likely to involve firearms, you're wind up really dealing with major injuries in situations where there's no available medical infrastructure if you happen to be the medic. Now, during the Civil War, the likelihood of ballistic trauma to the chest or abdomen proving fatal, that was about 70%. That's really high. You can expect similar results in primitive survival settings, even now. Is there anything you can do to decrease the death rate from hostile encounters? Yeah. You could consider body armor as part of your survival storage. Body armor has been used throughout history. The introduction of high-velocity firearms around the time of the Renaissance, however, negated the protective advantages of chainmail, ringmail, and plate armor. So body armor generally fell out of favor for combat purposes until the latter part of the 20th century. Body armor works by trapping a bullet in protective fibers and dispersing its energy, thereby slowing and flattening the bullet. Each layer of webbing slows the round until it deforms and stops completely. The impact is spread throughout the vest, causing the wearer to experience it over a larger area. The projectile itself, however, fails to penetrate the body, preventing the worst, but not all, injuries. It's important to know that a bullet causes a lot more damage than simply the hole it creates. While the protective capabilities of body armor may ensure that the risk of lethal injury is very low, the shockwave caused by the bullet can cause damage by indenting the inside of the armor. That's the part that's touching the body. This is known as backface deformation, or BFD, and even today it's an issue not fully addressed. BFD often occurs with ammunition that mushrooms, like hollow points, let's say, or like high-velocity rifle rounds that spin and yaw. There are two types of body armor, soft and hard. Soft body armor is useful for its lightweight nature. It's protective against handgun rounds, but doesn't stop rifle bullets. Hard body armor is characterized by rigid plates, which are effective even against rifle rounds. Now, this is most commonly used by the military and police tactical units. I have soft armor that I'm wearing it right now, as a matter of fact. I guess it's not very helpful since this is audio, but I'm wearing soft armor just for the feel of it because it's been a while since I've had it on. And it's something that you would barely notice under your shirt considering how streamlined they are these days. Soft armor is normally manufactured from woven synthetic fabrics and can be worn by itself or for more protection combined with hard armor. In these combos, a soft armor plate backer is usually placed behind the ballistic plate. There are different kinds of protection that are afforded by body armor. There's ballistic protection, which is protection against firearm projectiles. There's stab protection, which is protection against direct attacks with sharp weapons such as knives. There's spike protection, which is protection against other sharp weapons such as ice picks, needles, etc. Vests that provide stab and spike protection are especially useful in certain situations. You may wonder, why bother with that? Well, for corrections officers that have to deal with prisoners that may have shivs and things like that, they're actually very, very useful. Each of these protections is assessed by the U.S. in its National Institute of Justice. That has the responsibility of testing body armor and establishing standards. For ballistic rounds, the NIJ resistance standard classifies body armor by levels of performance against various types of ammo. How does the NIJ arrive at these standards? The department says that it takes samples of commercial body armor, subjects them to major wear and tear, then follows up with long-term ballistic testing. Here are the current body armor levels and the examples of the rounds that they can handle. The lightest armor is level 2A, and that stops 9mm and 40 Smith & Wesson caliber short-barreled handgun rounds. There's no rifle protection, however. Level 2, it stops 9mm and 357 Magnum caliber short-barreled handgun rounds. Also no rifle protection. Level 3A, 357 SIG and 44 caliber Magnum longer barreled handgun rounds. Still no rifle protection. You start getting rifle protection at level 3. And that stops 7.62 full metal jacket lead core rifle rounds slower than 2,780 feet per second and lighter than 147 grain. Level 4, well, that's the big stuff, and that stops 30-06 steel core armor-piercing rifle rounds and can defeat bullets lower than 2,880 feet per second and lighter than 166 grain. What about NATO ammo, 5.56 or 223, that you would find in AR? It depends on the core. Lead core rounds may be stopped with level 3 armor. The steel core rounds require a level 4 for reliable protection. So what makes the body armor so solid? A number of different materials have been used to produce these vests, which I'm calling bulletproof, but really they're bullet resistant. These vests materials are steel, ceramic, and plastic. Most of today's armor is made from materials like Kevlar. That's a man-made hydrocarbon fiber known for high strength, low weight, and both chemical and cut resistance. Kevlar is also flame resistant, doesn't melt, soften, or flow when heated. It's thought to be several times stronger than steel fiber. There are newer products, by the way, that claim to be even stronger than that. Then there's UHMWPE. That stands for Ultra High Molecular Weight Polyethylene. It's a polymer with a long molecular chain, allowing it to absorb energy more effectively. One brand is Dyneema, D-Y-N-E-E-M-A. A strand of Dyneema only 1 millimeter thick can bear up to a 240 kilogram load, yet it's light enough to float on water. Then there's ceramic. Modern ceramic is used to make a lightweight form of hard body armor. It consists of a layer of aluminum oxide, boron carbide, or silicon carbide on the outer surface backed up by a ductile fiber-reinforced plastic composite or metal layer. Of course, there's always steel. Solid steel plates are very protective, capable of withstanding more than one hit. They can be, however, heavy and restrictive. Often they're coated with materials that decrease damage caused by fragmentation, which, by the way, has its own term. That is called spalling, S-P-A-L-L-I-N-G. So is heavy NIJ-rated armor always superior to light? If you're talking about taking a rifle round to the chest, yes, but there are disadvantages to, say, level 4 plates. Needless to say, they're heavier. You have reduced flexibility and comfort, and that leads to less ability to move quickly when you need to. They're also more noticeable, which can lead a hostile entity to aim for other parts of the body, like, say, your head. So what does it feel like to get shot with body armor on? Now, while you'll probably survive a shot to the vest, that doesn't mean you won't feel pain. Getting shot is often described as a sharp stinging sensation, but others report a dull thud. Still others compare it to being struck with a baseball bat. There'll be a strong backwards force that might knock people off their feet, which doesn't happen if a bullet penetrates you. The energy of the bullet is spread out over, let's say, your entire chest, and that will be more likely to change your balance, knock you to the ground.
With a vest on.
A study by the Akron, Ohio Police Department found that if the vest is appropriate for the round fired, 85% of those shot in the vest area receive minor or no injuries. Minor damage usually involves bruising, while moderate injuries, well, they may include cracked ribs. So as to feeling the impact, the most important factors in causing injuries are the caliber of the bullet and the distance from which it is fired. Larger caliber bullets will deliver more energy on impact and therefore more discomfort. Being shot at point blank range means, as you might imagine, more pain. Although you'll read mostly about torso armor, there are other components that protect the throat, the nape, the shoulder, and the groin as well. And of course, helmets and shields can be also available that withstand damage from firearm ammunition. It's important to know that body armor does not last forever. Over time, the material is weakened by wear and tear. Expect a shelf life of 5 to 20 years, depending on the materials and, of course, the storage conditions.
This is Joel Nendy, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Okay, well, I'm not really sure why he's hanging out in, you know, level 2 body armor under his shirt, but whatever. He said, just get the feel for it again, okay. But no, this is actually a really important topic. I do want to hit on one thing he said, and then I'll move on to my segment. He said that, you know, people describe the impact differently. Well, unless you're an idiot that's like you and your buddy are shooting at each other while you're wearing body armor for shits and giggles or something, which, please don't do that shit. Where you know the distance, the range, and all, and you're ready for it. Like, most of the people that are reporting this have actually been hit in the real world in some form of dangerous combat situation. And this varies anything from police officers hitting their vests, to people wearing full scale armor hitting, you know, actual military combat scenarios and things like that. And of course, it's all different. And it's a very simple explanation of why. You would say that a person, let's say, hit with something like a 30 cal round out of a rifle would probably feel more impact than somebody hit with something like a 357 round or a 38 special round even. Okay, it's just two different scenarios. The person shot with a 38 special plus P is shot by somebody breaking into a business and they happen to like know their business is as a pawn shop. And the guy's got a gun and he's got a vest underneath his clothes. He's wearing a vest like Doc Bones. So he's wearing a lower level of armor to begin with that's going to let more energy transfer, even though it's going to do a good job of stopping the round. He's shot at like 5 feet, right in the sternum, straight on. and he survives, and whether he kills the assailant or not, he lives to tell his tale. And he says he felt like somebody hit him in the chest with a hammer, which is probably true. Another scenario, a guy is out in, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq or some other theater. He takes a round to the chest about the same area. It's a 30 cal, 7.62-39 round. And it hits him at about 30-degree angle coming in from the side and glances off his armor. The guy that shoots him is 150 meters out. Well, there's some fall off in the velocity from the distance, but it's also the angle and the trajectory of impact. Again, and maybe the guy that got hit like that didn't even know he was going to get hit, so he had no anticipation, and that changes the feeling of impact. And the guy that got shot at 5 feet knew he was about to get shot, and that changes the feeling of impact. Both of those people would tell very different stories about what the impact's like. It saves lives. It doesn't mean you won't hurt. And then there's another thing I need to say before we move on to my segment. Body armor doesn't make you indestructible. It is designed to protect the areas of your torso that are where you are most likely to die if a round penetrates your body. It leaves some very vulnerable places completely unprotected, like your sides, okay, because a lateral pass-through, but, you know, maybe arms protect that or something to some degree, but you can still die if you're hit from the side. It leaves your neck and your head, which are your most vulnerable, and the very upper part of your torso, like down here by your collarbones, completely unprotected. And if you're hit there, it's generally speaking, when you're hitting those areas, some people are seriously injured and survive, but it's one of those things where most of the time it's either superficial or you're dead. They used to say during like the black powder days of warfare, like the American Revolution, the Civil War, and further back, if you're going to get hit on the battlefield, you're probably better off being hit in the head because either it's superficial or you're gone. Right? So you have those areas that are very vulnerable. And legs, and if you're hitting the femoral, in your upper thigh region, and you're hitting the femoral artery, you will bleed out very, very, very quickly. I'm talking under a minute for a full bleed out if you have a full cut of the femoral artery. So those areas are vulnerable. The other side of that, I've been to some classes where we've trained for like mass shooter situations, and we trained for what if the shooter that comes in, like has happened, is body armored up, strafe legs. That's what we were trained to do, strafe the legs. And just keep hammering until they go down. And then maybe you have some other, you know, opportunity to deal with the threat. All right, now let's go on to my segment today. I want to talk to you guys about blackout kits. And I think this is one of those really easy, simple layup prepper things that you can get your brother-in-law, who doesn't want to hear any of your prepper shit, to do. I think that anybody that wouldn't do this, there's something wrong in their brain. Like, they just don't. Maybe it's that they don't want to hear it from you, right? Maybe if it's your dad, you have what Dave Ramsey would call powdered butt syndrome, somebody that, you know, once powdered your ass and changed your diaper, doesn't want to take certain types of advice from you. I don't know. But most people should be completely open to the advice of you should have a blackout kit. I want to start out with what is a blackout kit and what isn't it? It is not a generator that you set up, fuel up, start up, run extension cords in your house with. And if you have a generator, it's like a standby Generac. You're fortunate you have natural gas, it's plumbed in, and your power goes off for 5 minutes and it turns right up. You probably don't need a blackout kit. It probably still wouldn't be a bad idea, you never know, but you probably don't need one the way most people do. A blackout kit is, let me give you the scenario. You are home and your spouse isn't. Doesn't matter if you're the man or the woman of the house, your spouse isn't, and you have two children. Your youngest child is old enough to, like, you can take a shower without them being fully supervised, but they're like, they're playing in your bedroom on your bed with their toys while you take a shower, so mom or dad can jump in, grab a shower, and come out and take care of the kid. And your older kid is downstairs playing video games in the living room, and it's after dark. It's 9:30 at night, and the other spouse is out doing something or gone away for something. And then the power goes off. When the power goes off, you have soap in your hair and your eyes. Hopefully you're not on a well so the water doesn't stop. At least you can rinse off. The youngest child that's in your bedroom starts crying and screaming and bawling because they're scared because it's completely dark now. Because the street lights, everything's out. right? So it's totally dark. You're in the bathroom. It's totally effing dark. You have no window and the doors are closed. You hear your kid screaming. The kid downstairs, being a little bit older and a little bit more, you know, just the way kids get when they're like teenagers, you know, is like, why? Who turned off the power? And they're bitching because they can't play their freaking video games anymore. And you're naked and you have soap in your eyes. Wouldn't it be great if at least there was basic visibility? There's a component to this that actually doesn't go in the kit that we'll cover in a second that would handle that. But even once you kind of like, you got a flashlight in your hand or whatever, like, now you got the kid scared, all this stuff's going on, and you need to take control of the situation. Somewhere in your home, in a location that's easy to get to, should be a box. And in that box should be your blackout kit. The primary purpose of that kit is to get light on so you can see. And once you can see, then everybody can calm the F down, and now you can think, and now whatever other protocols you have can be put into place. They're the first layer of the preparedness process. For the people we talked about, your brother-in-law, whatever, that thinks prepping is stupid, it might be all they have, but at least they'll have it. For you, hopefully, it will be you have other things, depending on how long the power's out, what you're going to do. So what goes in your blackout kit? Number one, and I have all of these things in a list in the show notes today with links to where you can get them. Some I've reviewed, some go straight to Amazon. You can use whatever you want. I just recommend the products that I trust. Number one, you want a good flashlight or two. I like mag lights. I like old school, like D-cell, C-cell mag lights. They have really long lasting capacity. I'm going to say some good things about Amazon Basics batteries, but when it comes down to it, for that first responder flashlight, I generally want D-cells. I generally want Duracells in those. I don't actually keep my mag lights in my blackout kit, though. I keep my mag lights on the windowsill in my kitchen. I can get them and go into the pantry with them to get the rest of the blackout kit out. And then there are other flashlights in the blackout kit. One thing that has definitely been in our blackout kit since we found it are the E-Tech City Lanterns. They're four for under $30. They're really great, and when you get them, you should totally put the batteries in them and test them, and then you should take the batteries out of them, and you should put them in plastic bags and not store them inside the device. Don't tell me that manufacturers have to replace any device damaged by a leaking battery, because it won't matter when your device is screwed up. And I've never heard anybody successfully do it anyway. So don't store the batteries inside the device. That's why my flashlight, my primary flashlights, my mag lights, sit on the windowsill in the kitchen, because since I use them, the batteries get replaced. That means I don't need to keep batteries inside anything in my blackout kit, okay? Except the stuff that's rechargeable, and then there's no way around that, okay? So I have a couple good flashlights, and then I have the LED lanterns. In rooms where the lanterns might be really, really useful, what we did is we took little tiny hooks that you can't even see, and you can even take some white spray paint or whatever color your roof is and spray paint over them so they completely blend in. Somewhere up there, screw into the roof a little bitty hook like you'd hang a flower pot from. Find a stud so it actually has some give, and do not do the dumb thing that I did once, and that is, well, you know, right near where the ceiling fan is good, and the power will be off so the ceiling fan won't be running, because the power coming gets the power back on, the ceiling fan starts running, it hits the lantern. So somewhere away from the ceiling fan a little bit, somewhere toward the center of the room, put one of these little hooks in. These lanterns work by when you pull them up, the light comes on, and when you push them down, it goes off. So what you can do then is you can hook the little handles up on that hook, pull it down, and it'll light the whole room for you. Now, it's not going to light the room like you got, you know, your high-output lights on, but you'll be able to see everywhere in the room. You can also just kind of reach up there if your ceilings aren't that high and you're a taller person, push them closed, and when you come into that room, you can pull them down and turn them on. That way the batteries last long. They last a long time. The ones I recommend are from E-Tech City. They are fantastic. If you get a DOA one, which will happen, these people sell thousands and thousands of these a week. An electronic product, you sell in that volume, you'll get a lemon or two. They will just, that's why I said try them as soon as they get there. They will just replace it for you. They sent me a direct email explaining that to me when I asked them about some reports of DOA items. And they just basically said, well, you know, we sell tens of thousands a week. You're going to have some bad ones. We just replace it. We don't even ask for a return. Okay, next, I think you should have a couple headlights at least. The ones that Vavor makes are fantastic. There's a link in the thing. This is so you can have hands-free light in places where it's not all lit up. because lighting is everything when the power goes out after dark. Once you have lighting, then you can worry about everything else. That's first layer response. So a couple of good headlights, extra batteries, at least two sets for everything in your kit, in Ziploc bags, in the kit, not in the device. I already explained why. Now here's the one thing that absolutely doesn't go in your kit because it will be useless to you if it does. What are called power failure lights. And I realized I hadn't reviewed any of these for a while, including the new ones I found. So that's the item of the day today. It's on the site. They're made by Energizer. They're great. And they're on sale today for a three-pack for like $22. And the way these work is they plug into any outlet. You turn them on, and while they're plugged in and they have power, they charge, but the light doesn't come on. You turn the power off, the light comes on. So you can plug them in throughout your house. The power goes off. They light up instantly. Now the kid's not crying, at least not as bad, and you can see to get the soap out of your freaking eyes and get some clothes on to go take care of your kid. Because you should have all your bathrooms should have one. Now, if you have a guest bathroom nobody ever really uses or something, one of those ones that's like a closet, and like even if you're taking a leak, all you do is reach over and the door handle's right there, maybe he doesn't need one. But like your main bathroom for your master bedroom and like your main bathroom, like the kids use or whatever, put one in there. Hallway, put one in there. Hallways are the transport corridors, right? Bedrooms that people actually use, put one in there. Main living area, put one in there. Kitchen, put one in there. Now the power goes out, but you can see everything. Now you're not seeing like high-end visual, like again, like you have all your high-level lights on or anything, but you're not going to break your neck and you can get where you need to go. Now you can get to your blackout kit and get the other things. The next thing you need is a good emergency radio. This is some place I'm going to apologize right now. I have let you down. The radio I've recommended for years is made by a company called Eton, E-T-O-N. They still make radios. They don't make the radio I've recommended for years. I have several different versions of that radio. Some of them are 15 years old, and they still work. Okay? That's a long time for a device like that to be completely dependable, and they are. Since I don't really know how good their new products are, and since one of them is almost $100, I'm not sure what to recommend, and I'm going to have to do some... I'll probably have to pick up a couple different brands and put them through their paces. But the one that I'm comfortable recommending right now is called the Condor 1, and it's very similar to the original Eton that I used to recommend. They're about $60. It is incredibly well reviewed, 5 stars, and everything I've done as far as research and all about it seems to be that it is a very good emergency radio. What I mean by an emergency radio, it has AM and FM. It will work with batteries or some form of hand crank or some way to recharge it even if the batteries are dead. It has the NOAA weather alert bands as well. And if it has some kind of light, all the better, though I would never rely on them as a, you know, specific lighting source, but it is useful. This is necessary because many times when the power is out, why is the power out? The power is out because there was a bad weather event, and maybe it's not done yet. And sometimes bad weather events are things like swirling clouds of death. We call those in Texas tornadoes. And you may need to be really alert to what's coming next, and that is your first line of defense in that until you can get other things operational. Chem lights. These are not a have-to-be or a need-to-be, but they're a nice-to-have. And honestly, if you have kids, you crack a chem light, you hand it to them, they're freaking happy. Crack two. They're cheap. There's a really good deal today, by the way, on chem lights that have the little thing where they're designed to be hooked onto things, and it's like a 30-pack, and it's really cheap. So I have those linked in the show notes today. I really don't care what brand of chem light you buy. But they're very useful, and again, they're the kind of thing that kids have fun with. And if kids are having fun when there's a power outage, you don't have to deal with their crap, and you can see the other things. Then I really think this is another nice-to-have you don't need to have is a notepad. And I'll tell you what Dorothy and I do whenever there's a power outage. Especially if it's at night. If it's during the day, it's different. If it's at night and it's not, you know, we're not in bed when it happens. We're like up and we were doing things and all of a sudden the power's out. And now all the stuff that we have, you know, internet access, et cetera, is all off. We sit down and we make notes of what do we wish we had right now that we don't have. And that list has gotten pretty short now because we've been doing it for 20 years. But in the beginning, it helped us tighten up our preps. And if you're going to have a notepad, I really recommend that you pick these up anyway. They're not expensive. They're simple little, you know, flip from the top spiral notepads that are waterproof, so they don't smudge or whatever. So they're good for other things like keeping in your glove box for notes you need to make or when you're out in the field or whatever. They don't smudge. They don't get messed up. And so I think a 5-pack of those is like $12. So I'd rather do that than your conventional notebook in there because, and it's also useful for during the time you have emergencies. You'll think, oh, I need to take care of this next, and then you won't because you'll forget because you did something else and you did another thing and then you forgot about it. Think about how many times you walk into a room to do a thing and you look over, oh, that needs doing first, then you do that, and then, oh, that thing needs to be done, and then you stand there and go, yeah, but that's not why I came in here, and why did I, and you don't know. And then you go back to the other room and you sit down and do something else. You go, oh, I was supposed to do that. If that happens when everything's peaceful, it's more likely to happen when the kids are crying, screaming, whatever. Yeah, there's an emergency. So it's good for that as well. Then you need something to keep all this in. We use a foldable shopping bag that sits like a box, and we use those for a lot of things, and they're fantastic. There's a link to those as well. And then it wouldn't be a bad idea to have like an 800-watt power inverter screwed to a board and a couple extension cords where before you even worry about a generator, maybe it's just some basic things that you want to keep charged and all. You can go out and hook that up to your car the way we've talked about for years and run an extension cord into the house, and you can run the car on idle when you need extra power. And then you decide how far you want to go with this. Again, if you have something like a backup Generac plumbed into, you know, natural gas from the utility company that will basically never run out, then you may not need this as badly as everybody else. If you don't have, you're not to that level, you need this. I've got 2 generators and 60 gallons of gas, and I do it the way you said. I numbered all my gas cans, 1 through 12, and I rotate my 5-gallon gas every month. First of the month, I take, you know, January, I put number 1 in, I refill it. And, yeah, it's great. And it's dark, and you're in the bathroom with soap in your eyes, and your kid's crying, and your other kid's screaming, and your spouse isn't there, and your generator's in the garage, and you have to go get it. You have to wheel it out. You have to get it started up. You have to make sure it has gas in it. You have to start running extension. You see what I'm saying? And if you don't have that, then you really need this. And then you think about other things. Like when I was living in Arlington, we had a fireplace. We always kept a box of those shitty fire logs. When we did a fire, usually, we did a normal fire with firewood. But when there was a power outage and it just needed to get done, we'd throw one of those fire logs in there and then throw some wood around it and light the fire log. And you don't have to watch it. You don't have to do anything. You go do other things. So you figure out the rest. But everybody should have a blackout kit. It is preparedness 101. And it is a very overlooked thing, even by people who are, you know, they have you know, a year's worth of MREs. They don't have a blackout kit. You know, it's back to what I told that kid that was doing work for me on my property a few weeks ago, cutting trees for me, and he's talking to me about the apocalypse, and I'm like, how long could you go without work before you were bankrupt? And he said, about a month. I said, you're not ready for the apocalypse. You can't handle cutting yourself, going to the hospital, not being able to work for a month. You're not ready for the grid to be down for 6 months. So why don't we get the basics taken care of? Anyway, with that, let me wrap things up. Let me again thank you for tuning in today and all week. I'll remind you, we will have a Friday flashback tomorrow. I haven't done it yet. I'm usually ahead on those, but I don't know what it's about, but it'll be pretty good. And again, the item of the day today is the Energizer Power Failure Lights. These are really great, and I want to say a little bit more about how your power failure lights in general here at the end. I used to recommend these a lot. They all disappeared, and then they came back. And let me tell you what happened. The original group of them, this generation that came out, first generation, they had a fatal flaw. They overcharged. Inevitably, what would happen is they'd come on when they weren't supposed to, and they'd just stay on, and eventually they'd completely destroy themselves, and they wouldn't work when you needed them. Or they might even, when they tried to turn on, like start to heat up and melt circuits and shit like that. And even the first generation of these did that, and I guess Energizer, wanting to keep their rankings, didn't like flush it and bring it back as a new product. They're completely fine. They use nickel metal hydride batteries. They did some for a while with lithium because they were looking for longevity. You don't need longevity here. You need reliability. So nickel metal hydride is the way to go. And the like, not just these, but all of them now are built much better than they were 15 years ago or even 10 years ago. And it was about, I'm going to say, seven, eight years ago, they just started to disappear, and then they started to come back after a few years. And the ones they make today are much better, not just this brand, but all of them. And then, but this is why I love the Energizer brand. It's not Energizer that I love. I don't care about the bunny or whatever, okay? These are made to where they can be taken apart. They're not supposed to be, but they are. And what I mean by that is, like, Energizers and say, hey, you can take this apart, but there's four screws. You take the four screws out, and they come apart. If you look in there, you'll see their special battery, which is nothing but a unbranded, it's funny for Energizer, isn't it, AAA nickel metal hydride battery. You know, it's a rechargeable, blah, 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 amp. It's a triple A battery, nickel metal hydride, which means you can then take it out and replace it with another rechargeable nickel metal hydride AAA battery, screw it back together, and it'll work. Why do I say this? Because the one person that really bitched about this in the reviews, I had this for 5 years, and then there was a storm, and the power went out, and it worked flawlessly, and about a year and a half later, the power went out again, and it didn't even work. So it was 6.5 years old. Do you expect a product like this to last 6.5 years from a battery perspective? No. Not if you're smart. That's a Ron White moment. You can fix a lot of things, but you can't fix stupid. Okay? This is not a lifetime purchase, especially the battery component of it. Again, three of them are like $22. What was the cost per year, even if they only lasted 5 years, which is great. But batteries are really cheap. So what I recommend you do is, however you maintain your schedule of maintenance in your home for all your stuff, add these in, and whatever day they go in 2 years later, pop them open, yank the battery out, replace them. It is literally a 1.5 minute job per unit. I mean, really, it's like 10 of them to be 15 minutes, and that's if you're slow, and you're enjoying yourself, and you're not really in a hurry. It's not hard. And then you'll never have to worry about it because they'll do better than 2 years for you. Or if you have one that, you know, starts to act a little funny, swap the battery out. And that's where I said the Amazon Basics battery line, they're pretty damn good and they're a hell of a value. Other than the things we absolutely depend on, like this needs to work because my life depends on it, pretty much we've standardized on them. And we keep a massive amount of them around in all the common sizes at all times, both in rechargeables for our rechargers and just, you know, off-the-shelf, ready-to-use, you know, alkaline batteries. So I would recommend those for these, and I wouldn't worry. Anyway, with that, I am going to wrap up. Thank you for tuning in today. Catch that Friday flashback tomorrow. If you haven't picked up a copy of Loss of Life yet, please do so. And if you have, please get back on Amazon and give us a review. It will really help us continue to reach new people who are not already part of the community. And when we grow the community, the whole community through network effect gets stronger. I thank you to all of you that have helped that happen over the years.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you'll